When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm LaToya Johnson, your host for the New Books Network, and I'm here with author and journalist Patrick Humphreys to discuss his book, Cleopatra and the Undoing of Hollywood, How One Film Almost Sunk the Studios. Thank you so much for being here with me, Patrick.
Pleasure.
I know. Thank you for being here all the way from London.
Yes.
To talk about this.
Wet, dry, miserable London. Yes.
To talk about this, you know, this immense, very studio intense film.
Yes.
So, you know, what began in 1958 as a $2 million film meant to star Joan Collins eventually became this 5-year chaotic affair, costing 20th Century Fox upwards of like $44 million.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's 1960s prices. So it probably would be certainly one of the most expensive films ever made. Yes, you're right. It began as a very modest little vehicle for the studio. I mean, it's not a biblical film, but there was that vogue in the 1950s for films like The Robe and particularly Ben-Hur, which did incredibly well looking at the Roman Empire. And Cleopatra was an obvious choice. So they thought, look, they could film it all in California, you know, desert to desert. We'll get Joan Collins. She's on contract. But it began spiraling early on. They needed a bigger star, and at the time, the biggest star in the world was Elizabeth Taylor. You know, she was front page news. She was on her fourth marriage. She'd broken up Eddie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds' marriage. I mean, they were America's sweethearts. You know, in that sort of very white bread Eisenhower period of the '50s, they really were. What every parent wanted their children to be like. And Elizabeth Taylor was seen as this homebreaker, this marriage breaker. So she was front page news, and then she was incredibly successful at the box office. And legend has it, she was in her bath, and 20th Century Fox rang and said, "We'd like you to play Cleopatra." And her then husband, Eddie Fisher, had answered the phone. So they wanted to play Cleopatra. And she said, "Well, tell them I'll do it for $1 million. And nobody had ever got $1 million from a movie before. So she was as surprised as anyone when they said yes. And that's when the problem started. I mean, I think there's a great, probably mini-series to be made out of the making of this film, because it's got everything. It's got sex, intrigue, hubris, chaos. It's got everything. And they thought they'd recreate the majesty and grandeur of ancient Egypt in England. I don't know if you know Buckinghamshire, but it bears little relation to the Mediterranean. But at that time in the late 50s and early 60s, the government offered very generous tax discounts to film companies if they employed the high percentage of British talent in any film. So they brought Cleopatra to England and built this incredible set. I think it's about 20 acres of ancient Alexandria. And you can see it on YouTube. I mean, it looks fantastic. But if it wasn't raining, there was so much fog, they literally couldn't see to the other side of the set. Elizabeth Taylor then got ill. She almost choked to death. She had to have a tracheotomy. So she was barely on set, even when it wasn't raining. It was a complete disaster. Then the crunch came. Let's don't forget, this is at a time when it's pre-internet, it's pre-fax, it's pre-email. A studio in Hollywood to communicate with London or Rome, where eventually the film ended up, was long transatlantic phone calls. You had to book in advance or cables, and very time consuming. The crunch came when they spent in the region of $7 million in 1961 for about 8 minutes of film. And the studio, I think, they could either say, right, that's it, we wipe off $8 million and, you know, say thanks very much, or let's try something new. So what they decided was, like, the original director, Reuben Mamoulian, went, and Joseph L. Mankiewicz came in, who Elizabeth Taylor got on very well with. They'd worked on a couple of films before, and she was very fond of him. It was an interesting choice. I mean, he got the Oscar famously for All About Eve. I think he was more of a dialogue director. You think of his best films, they're not epics in the sense of Cleopatra was. But to his credit, the film that he wanted to make was two films. He wanted the first one to be about the relationship Cleopatra had with Julius Caesar, who's played by Rex Harrison in the finished film, and I think delivers the best performance. I think, you know, beware the Ides of March, because I think when Rex Harrison goes, it's downhill from there. Then Richard Burton comes on the scene as Mark Antony, and so Mankiewicz always saw it. Now, it's not clear whether it would have been on respective nights or 1 year after another, but it was going to be a six-hour film. They got to Rome to begin filming. They thought, well, we've got rid of the English climate, it's going to be sunny. What else can possibly go wrong? Well, where to begin? Richard Burton arrived on the set, and there was an immediate chemistry between him and Elizabeth Taylor. The scale of the production was just running out of control. I mean, the Roman Forum they built for Cleopatra was only twice the size of the original Roman Forum. Everything was on this grand scale. And if you remember the film, the money shot is Cleopatra's entry into Rome on that incredible pyramid sphinx thing. Now, they estimate there was somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 extras for that one shot. Now, nobody's entirely sure how many there were, because the money was just running. People would sort of register as an extra and go to the end of the queue and register again. So nobody knows where the money went. But you look at that one shot, and when I was looking at it, I thought, you know, these days you're so used to CGI. You're used to somebody sitting in front of a computer and pressing buttons. But this involved up to 20,000 people who had to be, you know, got onto the location. They had to be fed, they had to be accommodated, they had to be put in costume, they had to be taken off the set. You were reliant on the weather. They had to do it twice because the first day was too close. I mean, the scale of it is just, it's unbelievable. And they employed, it's a terrific cast. The supporting cast is great. But again, it just ran out of control. I mean, the English actor George Cole, who played Caesar's manservant, he was originally meant to be in Rome for 14 weeks. He was there for 18 months on full salary. And this is true of so many of them. You know, it was spiraling out of control. And once he got to Rome, it went crazy.
So I just wanted to gain some clarification, because there seemed to have been a lot of just terrible logistics happening in the production. And just for clarification, was there not a completed script at the start of the film when Mamoulian?
There'd been three or four, as with many films, you know, that but no, Mankiewicz came on board as the director, but he was also an Oscar-winning writer, so he wanted to write the script. And it's a bit unclear, but I believe he wanted to film chronologically, which meant he'd be directing during the day, writing the script at night. And that really sort of was one of the issues which caused the delays in the film being made. And then, of course, at one point, it's hard to believe now, but 20th Century Fox sent a couple of publicists over to Rome because they felt the film wasn't getting enough publicity. Now, when the Burton-Taylor affair broke, I mean, they were both married at the time to different people. when it broke, it literally was front page news. I mean, you know, the Eichmann trial, the Cuban Missile Crisis, it knocked all this, the Berlin Wall going up, it knocked all this off the front page. And there's a lovely story I found where I think at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the world's journalists went to the White House. And this is the world on the brink of Armageddon. You know, this is really close. And Jackie Kennedy pulled one of them aside and said, do you think Elizabeth Taylor will marry Richard Burton? You know, the world was obsessed with this relationship. And it carried on and on and on. And somebody pointed out in one scene, Cleopatra's at her dressing table, and all the items on the dressing table were custom made by Bulgari. Yeah, and they're on there for a millisecond, and then they're on set. You know, the budgets for paper cups you could probably have made at least a film out of. You know, the whole thing was on this grandiose scale, and of course, it just kept going up and up and up. So then, of course, you got into this situation where the studio with 20th Century Fox was literally relying on this one film to save their studio.
Was this the first film on this grand scale that 20th Century Fox had produced? Was this the first?
No, they've done big budget movies before, but again, nothing on this scale. I mean, I don't think Cleopatra was single-handedly responsible for destroying the old studio system, because simultaneously, MGM were doing Mutiny on the Bounty with Marlon Brando and Trevor Howard. And Brando was just impossible. And it was being filmed in Tahiti, miles away from, again, from Hollywood. Directors came and went, scripts came and went. That came in at $30 million. And I think between them, those two films, I mean, 20th Century Fox really were in trouble with Cleopatra. And this is, of course, where the problems with the finished film came, because, as I say, Mankiewicz wanted two films out of it. The studio knew the only way they could claw the money back because of this intense interest in the Burton-Sader affair was to get it out in the cinemas as quickly as possible, which meant that they had to cut and cut and cut and cut. Well, I think the original print was about 4 hours, but then that had to be cut again to allow to get two performances a day in. So you ended up with this... I wouldn't say it's a flawed masterpiece, but I think had the opportunity to see for Mankiewicz to realize his vision, like, it would have been a far better film than it turned out.
And as Mankiewicz, as he was creating the script, was he writing the script for it to be a two-part movie? Is that what we've received?
No, that's what he envisaged. He always thought that there were two relationships that mattered, which was you know, Cleopatra and the Emperor of the Roman Empire, and then this burning affair with Mark Antony. And I think, you know, one of the flaws of the film is that Richard Burton, though his is a fascinating story. I mean, you know, there's three Richard Burtons. He was born Richie Jenkins in Wales at the height of the Great Depression, extreme poverty. Father was a miner. And he came to London. He blitzkrieged the London stage immediately after the Second World War. Hamlet, these fantastic Shakespearean performances. He made Shakespeare sexy. I mean, he was the heir to Olivier and Gielgud. Then he went to Hollywood and sold his soul to Hollywood. And the films weren't that great. He had a couple of he was in The Robe. It was a good boxer, but he didn't do very well in Hollywood. So his career wasn't exactly out of the top draw, and he saw this as an opportunity to, you know, really establish himself as a film star. But he never quite, to my mind, adapted his acting style to cinema. I mean, I think if you'd seen him on stage, I think it would have been mesmerizing. But he was always just his film acting seemed to be trying to make sure the people at the back of the theatre could hear him. You know, he just roars and blusters through it. Taylor, I always found her mid-Atlantic accent really irritating. And she's sort of shrewish. And as I say, when Rex Harrison goes, I think the film falls apart. I think it's also, it's quite a dull film. I mean, you don't really... I never really got involved in it. I mean, other epics of the time, like Spartacus or Fall of the Roman Empire or Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, these were really engrossing big screen spectacles that had characters that you could really identify with. And I never really got that with Cleopatra.
And speaking of the Taylor-Burton on-screen relationship, do you think that their relationship, I want to talk a little bit about their relationship off-screen and how you feel it affected the movie. Now, when it first premiered, were you able to understand the hoopla that was going on around it?
Oh, yeah. In the book, the local pub that my parents and I used to go to for big occasions, the Grove Tavern, sadly no longer in existence, with Christmas and the end of school terms. And a friend came by and said, oh, that actress, I just saw her having a drink in the Grove Tavern. I said, which actress? They said, she's married to that Welsh chap. Elizabeth said, my mother's lived, she couldn't believe. I mean, this is pre, mobile phones, paparazzi, anything, that this divine goddess could be perhaps sitting where she sat, over Christmas. So there was this incredible, tangible fascination with Burton and Taylor. And when, wherever they went, I mean, this is, I suppose the nearest equivalent, the Kardashians. I mean, every move was monitored, whatever they did, wherever they went, might not be front page news, but it was. When Cleopatra was finished and opened to very bad reviews, sluggish box office, Burton went to play Hamlet on Broadway, and it was the most successful run of any Shakespeare play, I think, in America. And it was like Beatlemania, the crowds just hoping to catch a glimpse of them were just everywhere. And it's interesting that the Beatles arrived in America in February 64. So it was immediately after Cleopatra had premiered. And they sort of presaged that whole new youth thing. And the thing was that when Cleopatra came out, Elizabeth Taylor was only 31. But you had these new stars like Julie Christie coming through, and younger actors like Tom Courtney and Albert Finney and Peter O'Toole. So they were competing with Burton and Taylor. And of course, the cinema going had changed as well. I mean, there just wasn't really that demand for those big screen old style spectacles. The 20th Century Fox persevered. I mean, you'd think they'd have learned their lesson, but they went ahead with things like Dr. Doolittle with Rex Hazard is a catastrophe. Star. Just lots of really bad big budget movies. Now, the studio was saved by The Sound of Music. It was this, that really saved. And also, in fairness, Daryl Zanuck, who took over the studio, there were two films running. One was Cleopatra, which is just hemorrhaging money. And he wanted to make The Longest Day, this film about the D-Day landings. And it was a real passion project for him. And he really struggled because in America at the time, not that many, obviously Americans have been involved in the Normandy landings, but it wasn't as well known perhaps as it was in the UK. But one of the board directors on the board of 20th Century Fox was a retired US Army general. And it was his vote that kept Daryl Zanuck on at 20th Century Fox, which greenlighted The Longest Day, but also meant that they had to get Cleopatra out there as well. And when it was sold to television in the mid-60s, I think it began clawing the money back,
In Chapter 13, Patrick, you write about the studio heads who were tyrannical in their exercise of power and the birth of the concept of the casting couch and how women were treated in the studios. But it seems that Taylor was able to really exercise her demands. I know as a reader, it seemed at whim that she was just able to be demanding, not only with her fee of $1 million, but also not having the film occur in the United States, which it seemed that was her idea, insisting that Rex Harrison be Caesar. Was that her idea as well? Yes. And the use of Todd AO film and rushes, as we now know as dailies. And I was just curious to know, considering how women were treated in the Hollywood studio system, how was she able to exercise so much power?
Well, that's a very good point. Yes, I mean, you know, the Me Too movement is not new. I mean, you know, famously, there's a famous unrepeatable Marilyn Monroe quote about when she finally got her contract for 20th Century Fox. I mean, Daryl Zanuck was notorious for quote-unquote testing new female talents at the studio. I suppose it's like, you know, the one thing Hollywood loves is success, and Taylor was box office success. She'd had a run of, you know, she'd been a star since she was 13, and she could open a film, and the notoriety surrounding Cleopatra certainly helped. But no, it's a good point. She was very astute, and it's interesting the contrast in the acting styles. Burton initially dismissed her as being, you know, just a movie star. But he said, well, you don't do anything, you know. And he said when he saw The Rushes, he could see that, you know, her doing nothing just filled the screen. You know, she was very astute, and she had a very good commercial eye. And I think you're right. If she worked well with somebody, there was a loyalty she had to them, which you didn't often get in Hollywood. I think people who worked with her were very fond of her.
Also in the book, you mentioned the Cleopatra Papers, which was published in 1963 by Simon & Schuster. And I'm intrigued of what work and research that went into the book. Like, was a lot of it of you operating off of like memory of what was happening during that time? Or what methods?
None of the principals were alive. Jean Marsh, who played Mark Antony's wife, Richard O'Sullivan, who played the Boy King, are alive, but are not well. You know, we're talking, over 60 years ago, so it's no real surprise. But, of course, so much has been written about, I mean, I think I read 5 Elizabeth Taylor biographies and, you know, 2 or 3 Richard. A lot has been written about the film and about the stars. But also I was fascinated by the studio system. And, you know, my memories are very much of going to the movies at that age. You know, you're 10, 11, as I say, you're restricted to very dull, grown-up black and white programs on your tiny little television set. And you get to the cinema and that whole world is opened up to you, you know, whether it's... I just did a piece for a magazine about the Guns of Navarone, you know, which was a fantastic for an 11-year-old boy who'd grown up in the shadow of the Second World War. It was fantastic, and all these big screen films. It sort of came, a lot of it came back to me very nostalgically, but I think also writing it and researching it, you knew that on the horizon, this really was the end of an era. You know, as I say, I think. The double body blow of Cleopatra and Mutiny on the Bounty really helped bring the old studio system to an end, because coming over the horizon were films like Easy Rider and The Graduate. You know, they young people weren't interested in those big budget movies with the stars who they saw as old. You know, they wanted younger heroes and heroines, which the big studios were reluctant to supply. It was sort of independent filmmakers, and a lot of UK studios were producing. I mean, the year Cleopatra came out, Tom Jones, the Albert Finney film, which was, you know, quite, I won't say avant-garde, but it was of its time, was quite left field. That swept up very well, and suddenly the American studios got interested in what was happening in the UK. And for the book I've just finished writing is about the Beatles, and Hard Day's Night, they were given 6 weeks to make this film about this English phenomenon, the Beatles, because they saw by the time it came out, the world might have forgotten about them, you know. But that drew Americans to the UK. But all this was sort of, you know, Cleopatra cast this vast shadow over filmmaking for a long period, and I guess it's become synonymous with what can go wrong when you make a movie on that scale, and nobody's really in control. Nobody really, you know, nobody's got the guts to say and say that you're wrong. I think if following the debacle in the UK, if some studio executive had the guts to say, okay, let's write off $8 million, let's forget it, and you know, move on to something else. But they clung to this idea that, you know, the big box office stars on and film on this spectacle, it couldn't go wrong, you know. And you think, well, actually, there's nobody learned their lesson, because when I was finishing the book, I learned that Warner Brothers had pulled the plug on Catwoman. They'd invested $100 million in this film, and it was so bad that it'll never ever be screened anywhere, you know. And this is, what, 60 years on from Cleopatra. So Hollywood's on a very slow learning curve, I fear.
While I was reading Cleopatra and the Undoing of Hollywood, I noticed that it's not solely about this particular film, but also about this entire ecosystem made up of movie stars and studio politics and the birth of paparazzi journalism and culture, and how celebrities' lives began to overshadow contemporary socio-political issues and socio-economic issues. Like, you do mention that the impending Cuban Missile Crisis was happening, and the erection of the Berlin Wall was going on, and people can't see what's happening because
I mean, at least, you know, I remember, I was 10 or 11, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I remember my parents being frightened. You know, your parents didn't do frightened. And they were really, I mean, this was like nose to nose. You know, this was really terrifying. And when the Berlin Wall went up again, you thought, well, this is, you know, we're on the brink of something here. This was, you know, these were life-changing events. But maybe it's because of these terrifying events that people seek sanctuary in glamorous lives of celebrities and films that bear no relations. I mean, that's true today, certainly. I mean, but at the time, I mean, there had been this, you know, yes. I mean, I always saw my book about Cleopatra being on a bigger canvas. It wasn't just about that one film. It was, you know, the way that the movies began to shape our lives, really, you know. Stars like, I mean, I was watching a documentary the other day about Charlie Chaplin, and good South London boy born just up the road to where I live, not far away from David Bowie, you know, so we're in a pretty good area around here. And Chaplin, I mean, people, writers, actors had visited America before and had done very well. Sarah Bernhardt, Oscar Wilde had appeared in America to audiences. But Chaplin, of course, was the world's first superstar, because it was on film and it could go everywhere. And of course, he didn't speak. So it appealed to him. So I was fascinated with that. Then you go through, then the talkies come and people dismiss it as a novelty. But of course, audiences wanted to hear the stars talk. And then you had that golden age of the musicals and in the 30s and Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz and these fantastic films. And then you have the war. And then after that, you have film noir. A very dark side of Hollywood came out. Then in the 50s, you've got the to combat the rise of television, you've got the big budget movies. Again, a lot of them biblical themes, because you get thousands of extras building pyramids or having chariot races. And, you know, that got the audiences away from television. So it's that fascinating rise and fall of the films. I think it is fascinating and remains fascinating. You know, I mean, at the moment, Hollywood just seems completely bankrupt. I mean, they're remaking classic movies. They seem to run out of ideas. You know, they're relying so much on Marvel Comics universe, and they seem to have tanked now. You know, I mean, there's this fascinating thing. I mean, are the movies a reflection of our society, or do we reflect the movies? I mean,
now that is a good question. That is a fabulous question. So when you started writing Cleopatra and the Undoing of Hollywood, did you intend to write a book on film history? Was that the intent?
No, I think what I've always found, every book I've written, and they've been mainly about music, music subjects, every book I've written, I think you need to put the subject in the context of what else was around at the time. And I mean, for the Beatles, for example, I mean, you know, every book that seems to be written, the Beatles said, oh, they're fantastic, they're brilliant, everything they did is great. Well, up to a point. I mean, I think what's interesting is putting in context what they did with what everybody else was doing. And I feel that's true of Cleopatra. that there's so much that the studios could have learned from previous successes, smaller budget films, taking a different approach to subjects. But they didn't, and they never seem to learn from their mistakes, you know. And it's like, I mean, when Gone with the Wind, Selznick said he was going to do Gone with the Wind, everyone said, oh, don't, you know, nobody's made a dime out of Civil War movies, you know. And it went on to become, I think it's not the most successful film, but I think it's the film that's been seen by more people than any other film, which, of course, you know, is a testament to the film itself, but also the time that produced it. So, no, he was sort of saying, well, here's this extraordinary period in film history where I think they were blindsided by Ben-Hur. Ben-Hur cost $15 million, which was a huge sum at the time. That was only a third of what Cleopatra came to cost. But it did very well at the box office. It did, I think, up until Titanic was the most successful, got the most number of Oscars for any one film. So I think, folks, we can replicate that with Cleopatra. But as you mentioned earlier, there wasn't a finished script. The production was running out of control. Ben-Hur was very much the vision of the director, William Wyler. Cleopatra changed directors. Also, the locations were complicated, it casting and everything. So I tried to put it in context of why I felt it failed, why I thought it was a bad film. I mean, I'm hoping to do a talk locally about it, and they think they can get the film to see. Now, I haven't seen it. I saw it at the National Film Theatre in London about 20 years ago, but it was a very faded print, and it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Apparently, there is a version that's been cleaned up, so I'm hoping to see it again for the first time in getting on for 60 years, and see what it's like, you know. I've been quite negative about it in the book. I'd be very interested. I've got a gut feeling it's not going to be great. I think there are so many flaws in the film, whereas, as I say, earlier films that dealt with similar themes, like, I mean, Spartacus, for example, the Kubrick film, you know, that conveys very complex ideas about power and the inheritance of power and the grappling for power with the senators and then Cleopatra, you don't quite get that. The, you know, uneasy lies ahead that wears a crown. It doesn't really come across in Cleopatra. And you've got 3.5 hours to do it, you know, and it's still, it, you know, it's a magnificent failure.
Do you think, had it not been for Taylor and Burton's relationship, do you think the film would have a different history?
That's a good point. Yes, I think if the weather had been better in Britain, the original casting was Stephen Boyd in the Richard Burton role, he was very hot after Ben-Hur. Peter Finch playing Caesar, who was a very good actor. I think Joan Collins would have done a very good job. I think it would have been one of those quite modest films. But there is something about it. I mean, Cleopatra's like, it is like Titanic. You know, it is this sort of huge symbol of Hollywood's excess. And it's like one of those huge cargo ships you see. And, you know, to make it stop, you know, it takes hours to bring these huge shuddering vehicles to a halt. And I think that's one of the problems with Cleopatra. It just spiraled out of control. A more modest version, I think, would have recouped its budget a lot quicker. It wouldn't have had the same publicity. And yes, interesting question. What would Burton and Taylor's careers have been like? Because again, after Cleopatra, and I remember this very well, as I said, the Kardashian comparison, the everything they did. You know, they came to London. They'd always have their dogs with them, and they'd hire this ridiculously big yacht in the River Thames so the dogs could stay on board and wouldn't have to go to the English quarantine system. And, you know, they threw these lavish parties, and they made some terrible films together. The one they did immediately after Cleopatra, The VIPs, have you seen that?
I have not, yes, but I know that you talk excessively about it in the book. Now I want to see it.
Yeah, I mean, there is a real frisson between them in that. There is a sexual chemistry, I was lacking in Cleopatra. And again, it's quite a modern, you know, it's got a great script by Terence Rattigan, and, you know, he's a very accomplished playwright and scriptwriter. And it's quite a modest film. But I think, you know, they could work well together. And then there were some good films that he made, so they weren't all bad. But I think the brand overtook, the Burtons, you know, overtook them. And Burton, you know, was an alcoholic. I mean, he was, you know, at a time, and it was seen as quite macho, you know, Richard Harris, Peter O'Toole, Hellraisers, you know, everyone thought, oh, yeah, you know. And I think that affected his work. You know, when he bothered in like The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, he could still deliver a very good performance. But again, the brand, the Burtons, you know, their lifestyle meant they had to do these movies that paid ridiculously large sums of money for them just so they could maintain their lifestyle.
Patrick, you've published works on musicians, you know, such as the Rolling Stones, Elton John, Bob Dylan, and Pink Floyd. How was writing a book about the film industry different and similar from writing about the music industry?
Well, it made a very nice change because in music, I mean, by and large, it's if it's a group, it's that group and their record label and their manager. And the tours and the LPs, and that's sort of fairly contained. With Cleopatra, you've got this huge canvas you're trying to fill, and as I say, trying to put it in context meant looking at, you know, pretty much the entire history of movies. You know, going right back to, you know, epic films like, I mean, Birth of a Nation, the D.W. Griffiths film, is a landmark. It's made in 1919. It's a landmark film, but its depiction of people of color and the Ku Klux Klan it leaves you reeling. You know, it's wholly unacceptable today. But it is a masterpiece of filmmaking. You know, it virtually invented the language of cinema. So to go from that through a certain periods I mentioned earlier, film noir, big budget things, sorry. For me, absolutely fascinating. And it's also a real opportunity to pull some DVDs down from the shelves. And, you know, I haven't seen that for a few years. I wonder how that stands up, you know. And so it was a real treat, actually, to do it. I can't think of another film that you'd really want to invest that amount of time in, because so much has been written. I mean, there are books about The Godfather and 2001, these landmark films, the legendary films. I can't think of any other one that I particularly want to. I think my sort of heart is very much in the way those films affected me when I was a kid, going to the cinema, and you know, the lights would go down, and for a big film like this, you'd have a souvenir brochure. The cinemas would probably have, in Cleopatra's sense, they would recreate sort of ancient Egypt in the foyer. And you really felt it was an event. I think it's a reconnect to me with the lost childhood, you know. So that was fun, you know.
Now, Patrick, I usually refrain from asking authors what they're working on because, of course, writing and creating can be incredibly tedious and intensive. But I can say, and you've already mentioned it, that you have another book that is publishing soon. And it's titled With the Beatles.
Yes, yes, yes. Me and my close friends, Paul, George and Ringo. Yes. Well, I was very lucky as a music job. It's hard to believe, look at me now, but I began as a hip young gunslinger on the weekly New Musical Express in 1976 when I was a freelancer. I went to staff at Melody Maker, then to a monthly magazine called Vox. I went freelance for a lot of the UK national papers. And over the years, I was very lucky to interview a lot of, you know, people whose music I really admire. And I did, I was on my brief and fairly disastrous spell in music PR. One of their clients was Paul McCartney, and he owns the Buddy Holly song catalogue. And in London in the 80s, he used to do these Buddy Holly weeks. He'd gig, or he'd get fellow musicians talking about Buddy or whatever. And I did a press release, and they said, "Oh, Paul really liked it. Come down to MPL to meet him." So, I mean, you know, you get to meet a Beatle. I mean, you know, and I gibbered but the one astute thing I did was on the way out, I said to his manager, "Look, I'm leaving PR and going back to journalism, freelancing." And I gave him my cards. If Paul ever needs a press release about an album or anything, just so. So what happened was, over a period of about 10 or 12 years, if they wanted a press release or an interview, they'd contact me direct without having to go through the record company or the PR. So I met Paul on a couple of dozen occasions in various circumstances. George I did for an album. Ringo I did for a DVD, both very long interviews. And after I did my Stones book, I was talking to my dear friend Bill Brook, and I said, you know, I'm kind of tempted to do a book on the Beatles because, you know, with lockdown and everything, I don't know. And he said, well, you met the three of them, didn't you? I said, oh, yeah. And he said, well, there's very few writers can claim that, you know. Why not? So I did, and I started going to all. And the thing, if you do an interview for a press release or even a magazine or newspaper feature, you only usually end up using about, you know, maybe 40 or 50% of what you've got. And I just found these interviews, particularly with Paul, stuff I'd never seen in print before, and him talking very fondly about John and about the Beatles, and I just thought, this is great, you know. So I put that together in the book. And also, I think one thing that I think about the Beatles, there hasn't been a full-length biography of them for nearly 20 years. And the ones that have been written are, with all due respect, by American people. And they just don't get the Englishness. They don't get the class issues. They don't get the geographical distance between London and Liverpool. Brian's Jewishness. There are so many elements that I think is not ignored, but needed amplifying. And also, I could draw on interviews I've done with three members of the most successful and most widely emulated band of all time. You know, so when Paul is talking about writing songs with John and he wants to reverse the writing credits, you know, he justifies that very, very plainly and very emphatically. The reasons why, and all this sort of stuff. And then I got to a point where most of the biographies finished in 1970 when they broke up. And I think what's really one of the many, many interesting things about the Beatles is the way that the brand carries on. In the UK, virtually every day there's something about the Beatles. On the Antiques Roadshow, somebody will come up with an autograph. A friend sent me the other day two photographs his sister took that I've never seen before. The internet is full of rare photos, bootlegs, demos, everything. They got to number one on the charts last year. You know, it just goes on and on and on. So I think that needed looking at. And, you know, were they as good as you remember? And the answer is emphatically yes. I mean, they're the yardstick by which you measure every group. You know, Kurt Cobain put a hidden track on Nevermind because he loved Abbey Road. You know, I mean, they're just everywhere. And you go from, in the UK, you go from Love Me Do to Strawberry Fields in 4 years, and you're never going to get that again. You know, not even Coldplay could match that. You know, they're just in a league of their own. So that's been great fun.
And of course, our Beyonce just re-recorded Blackbird, which Paul McCartney said that he loved.
I mean, it is just everywhere. I mean, you've got that incredible body of work. I think the Americans got shortchanged because the albums of Beatle fashion for the UK were very different from the ones that appeared in America. And it was only when they came out on CD that the American audience really appreciated just how cohesive they were. And there's just so many elements to the story. And as you say, absolutely, I mean, bang up to date. They just never seem to go away. And, you know, Paul, bless him, Paul keeps touring. You know, I think he'll do it till he drops. You know, it's what he loves. And, you know, when I first met him, he was very reluctant to talk about the Beatles because Wings were doing very well. And And I think it's just got to a point. It's, you know, I was 25% of the world's most influential band. I was 50% of rock's most influential songwriting partnership. If I can't talk about the Beatles, then who can? And of course, once you opened the floodgate, you just couldn't stop. You know, he was just, memories just came flooding out, you know, based with his favourite song was. And when he finished writing Hey Jude and playing it to John for the first time, and I'm going, you know, so yeah, it's very privileged actually. You know, in fact, I've got to the, I just looked it up the other, you probably can't see it, but I've got mine. This was my 1963 Christmas present.
Oh,
I've got, it's just so you probably can't see this, but I got Paul. I got Paul George and Ringo to sign it. So I was very monocopy. My mum bought me.
And Patrick, just for our listeners, can you explain what you just showed me just now?
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah.
in Christmas 1963, Beatlemania was in the UK. It was this tsunami. Every politicians, comedians, everyone was. And I got Please Please Me, their first LP for Christmas. Yeah. Mono version, and when I interviewed Paul for the first time, I took it along and he signed it. Mm-hmm. And then I did Ringo and he signed it, and then George signed it, and they all used to forge each other's signatures. And I was almost tempted to say to George, oh, while you're at it, could you do John for me? But I thought authentic Beatles. I missed John by a couple of months. I was on Melody Maker, which is one of the UK music weeklies, and he was due to make a private trip back to the UK in early 1981. And my editor, Ray Coleman, had been an early champion of the Beatles. And he was one of the few journalists that John really liked. And he mentioned to me that John might be coming back. And I said, oh, you know, I've never met a Beatle. And he said, well, you know, we'll see what we can arrange. Well, you know, tragically, it never happened. You know, but Paul, George and Ringo was pretty good.
And so it's very interesting that Beatlemania was just gaining some traction as Cleopatra was coming into the world. I like how you've bridged them together.
Yes. I mean, there's a point in the book where Burton and Taylor were landing at some airport and there were thousands of screaming fans, and they braced themselves to go through the, you know, turmoil, and somebody said, oh, no, it's for the Beatles, you know, and I think they kind of breathed a sigh of relief, you know, because I think they thought, well, there's somebody else sharing it, you know.
Is there anything that you want readers to keep in mind as they're reading Cleopatra and the Undoing of Hollywood?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
Is there anything in particular that you want readers to take away from Cleopatra and the Undoing of Hollywood?
Well, I hope that they enjoyed that roller coaster ride of you know, through film history to a certain extent, and the way that how these things spiral out of control. And I mean, nobody sets out to make a bad movie. I mean, even the worst executives don't set out to make a bad movie. And you know, you read accounts of you know, the first couple of Godfather of the studio, you know, Coppola played the studio. I mean, I'm really going to be sacked after a couple of weeks, you know. There's this incredible formula that goes into making a classic movie. And I suppose the reverse side of it is Cleopatra, where, you know, it's not a bad film. You know, Mankiewicz is an incredibly talented director, but, you know, it has to be said that it almost finished his career. I think he only ever made three movies after that. Only one of which really was any good, which was Sleuth, which is basically a film play, Michael Caine and Laurence Olivier. I mean, a great, you know, great film, but a film play. I think it kind of finished his career. So there's a really sad postscript to that. But I'd like to think that, you know, in reading it, you get an idea of what went into making a film on that scale. And now, I think literally you can do it. You know, even the most casual cinema viewer looks at something, a big epic film on screen, and thinks, oh yeah, that's all CGI. I mean, that's, you know, that's somebody sitting in front of a computer pressing buttons, and that galaxy's not really exploding, and that's not really, you know, 60,000 people on camels, or, you know. Whereas back in the day, it really was, You know, it was, you know, the Cleopatra's barge was a life-size, you know, 750,000 vehicle boat sail, you know, and God knows where it ended up. I mean, you know, it just, again, just the profligacy. And I think it's sort of, it's always like a warning, you know, is, you know, beware of your dreams, you know, because you do something on that scale and you've got to be so committed to it. It's got to be so right. And I'm afraid it's just so wrong. It's so wrong on so many levels. But having said that, let's get in touch in a couple of weeks. And when I've seen it again for the first time on the big screen, let's see if it's any better than I remember it.
Awesome. Cleopatra and the Undoing of Hollywood is out now. Patrick, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
It's been a pleasure. It's been lovely.